My name is John R. Peavy. I live at 8800 BC Avenue, McAllen, Texas. In 1905, my father decided to move to Texas. He wanted to pioneer in a new country. So we were moved from St. Louis, Missouri, in the winter of 1905 to Brownsville, Texas, and near Brownsville, where my father bought a ranch. And we were out among the Mexican people that were working on the ranch, and no one spoke English. Naturally, my four brothers and I learned to speak the language very rapidly. We were very much impressed by the friendliness of the Mexican people that we met here. And they were sympathetic. If you're in trouble, there are no people in the world that are kinder than they are.
Mr. Peavy, could you describe some of your adventures with smuggling activities while working with law enforcement? I understand that you have spent 33 years in law enforcement, with 30 of these years being with the U.S. Immigration Office. Could you relate some of these to us?
Yes, I could. I became very much interested in law enforcement outlaws from Mexico were crossing onto the Texas side of the river and molesting our ranchmen and destroying property and stealing horses and saddles. And I was at the sheriff of Cameron County, knowing that I knew this country and most of the people that lived in it. There wasn't as many people in this country as there is now. At that time, everybody had time to talk. And whenever you met a man, you're traveling horseback, you always stopped and talked with him. Nowadays, you pass him in an automobile, and you've seen him, and sometimes you're not able to recognize him. But in the olden days, people took plenty of time to visit with each other. And I became acquainted throughout the Rio Grande Valley with many, many people. And I knew all of the people that lived in the little settlements along the river. And I visited with them. Consequently, when we were having our trouble with outlaws from Mexico, the sheriff of Cameron County asked me to take a job as deputy sheriff. And I served there 1 year until when the army was brought in here. They were using me as an interpreter at Fort Brown to interview and interrogate the different people Mexican people had been picked up by the soldiers along the river. The reason for this was to get the information on what revolutionary activity was going on in Mexico and was it in our area, and to be informed as who and just who these revolutionists were, the leaders. It reached the point where it became embarrassing to the district commander to keep calling me without any compensation to me. And so he told me one day, Colonel Camel, he told me that he had used me a great deal out there, and that he felt like that was something ought to be done to have a permanent interpreter there. And he said he'd been authorized by the Army in Washington to set up a troop of scouts. And he said, you're qualified for it. He said, you have the knowledge of the country and the people. And he says, you've got the nature. You're naturally a lawman. And he said, I think you'd make a good man. And I'd like to have you take that job if you'll take it. Well, I asked him, I said, well, what'll it pay? And he says, it'll pay $125 a month. And he says, you'll have I want you to organize a troop of 16 scouts. And he said, I don't want a booze fighter in the bunch. He said, I want them to be have plenty of guts, and willing to fight, and afraid of the devil, and not afraid of the devil. And if you can do that, we'd like to have you take it. He said, we'll give you a house in Fort Brown to live in, and you can, we'll feed and take care of your horses. You'll have all of the privileges, just the same as an army officer has. Have make all your purchases of your food and what and so forth from the army's quartermaster corps. Supply depot, and he says, well, I said, you've hired a man. I said, I've only been drawing $60 a month from the county, but I said, I can take that $125 and then a house on top of that, and I said, I can do pretty well. So I served with him 1 year in that capacity, and that we were working horseback, and the obligation that I took was that in the event that we were ordered into Mexico in pursuit of these outlaws who had been molesting the American people and the people living along this river, to pursue them and punish them for what they had done. And if I was willing to take it, why, they'd be glad to have me take it. I said, I'd be tickled at that, too. So I took the job as chief scout for the military district from Brownsville to Roma. And I knew where I could pick up the men that were qualified according to what the colonel said. They must speak Spanish. He didn't care whether they could read or write. He said I don't want a booze fire. A drunkard in the bunch. I'm kind of having trouble in the bunch. And says, if you'll. So I went to work and created this scout company, and each one of them took the same obligation that I did, that in the event we were ordered into Mexico, the army was ordered into Mexico, we would spearhead the army and keep them informed of what's ahead of them. And however, we never ordered into Mexico, but we did patrol the river and keep informed on what revolutionary units on the Mexican side, where they were and who they were, and to be able to convey this information to the district commander or the section commander wherever we were at along this river, to keep them informed about what was over there. And on one occasion, I was detailed to go to Mier, to Mexico. General Carranza was a gentleman and a scholar, and he was one of the finest people I think I've ever met. And he tried to create a good relationship. He was the only revolutionary general that ever tried to create a good relationship with the United States. It was his desire to be on good terms. So, on one occasion, a special agent from Mexico was sent over to Fort Brown. He was a Carrancista officer and advised Colonel Hickok that they were holding three men at Mier. That's across the river from Rio Grande City and 8 miles northwest of Rio Grande City. And he wanted to know he wanted to know if the colonel could send an agent up there to interview these three who were held as prisoners. And if they were American citizens, he wanted them turned over to us, to myself, and to the American authorities, and taken into federal court and charged them with violation of the neutrality law. And if they were Mexican citizens, just they'd take care of them. And so the colonel called Gene Parker, and he and I were detailed to go to Mir and question these people. And we left in the morning. We had an old Model T Ford. We drove up there, up to Roma, crossed the river on a barge. What do you call them? A small
ferry.
Ferry. Yeah. And we met this Jefe de las Fuerzas de Carranza. They already knew we were coming, and so we went on up to the town of Mir. Now Mir is the town where the 104 Texans were captured and held prisoners in 1842, and there's where they had, and some people say that's where they had the drawing of the black and white beans, but that's not true. It was at Salalo where they had the drawing of the beans. They were on the march to Mexico City. They had taken these Texans prisoners, and they were taking them to a prison in Mexico City, overland. And at Salalo, they received orders from Santana, the president of Mexico, or dictator of Mexico, to perform this act of the drawing of the black and white beans. For what reason, nobody knew, except that he wanted to demonstrate his authority and his importance. See, in 1842 was a long time ago. That's before we had the Mexican War. See, the Mexican War happened in 1846, and that's when Zachary Taylor was sent to the Valley. And however, we interviewed these people, and we found one of them was able to get released. He was a U.S. citizen, but it was just a coincidence that he was picked up by the Carrancistas. He was in the pasture looking after his goats, and these other revolutionists were in that pasture, and the Carrancistas surrounded them and captured two of them, including him. So after the interview, I convinced the officer in charge of the garrison at Mir that they were not. That he wasn't guilty of any revolutionary activity, and that he was merely out there taking care of his goats. And he happened to be a brother to the sheriff of Duval County. But the other two, they just took them out and executed them. We stood there and watched them do the execution. Well, then they had to, naturally, the Mexican people are great on celebrating. And they had been drinking tequila, and they were a pretty wild bunch, and they wanted us to stay and have supper with, have a dinner, and they put on a spread, which I describe in my book. I was greatly impressed by all these things, and when I was 14 years old, I started keeping a diary for the purpose of writing a book. I had that urge. And I kept that diary up for 50 years. And in 63, I wrote a book, Echoes from the Rio Grande. And I've sold a great many of those books. In fact, I've made $15,000 profit on that book. So, anyway, after the meal was over, this was one of the thrills of my life, and I really was scared. And this, it started raining, and we decided we'd better get away, get going back home. When we came to the ferry on the Mexican side, the river was on a rampage, and the Mexicans that were operating the ferry didn't want to cross us, so they said it was dangerous. But we convinced them with a $10 bill that it would be better to, we'd take a chance. So we put the car on this ferry, and it was pitch dark and pouring rain. And Gene Parker and I were going to pull on the cable to pull the boat over. You see, had a cable across the river, you see, and you'd pull on the cable to make the boat move forward, this barge. So we were getting along fine. They told us to take off our cowboy boots, which we did. And we were up to within about 10, 12 feet from the Texas side of the river when a big tree swung around that had been carried by the current, swung around and hit this ferry, and it kind of upped on one side. We thought we was going to dump the whole car and everything else back into the river. But the cable broke, and down the river we went, and round and round until we didn't know which was Texas and which was Mexico. And I don't know how far we drifted anyway. We couldn't do anything about it, just simply hang on. But we finally, the ferry drifted up against the Texas side of the river, and these Mexican boys jumped off, and they tied a rope to a tree on the bank and held the ferry up to the bank. And then they left. And a little while, we thought, of course, they'd deserted us. But a little while, they came back. And they had a pair of mules and a wagon and a lot of timbers and a bunch of men. That's just how they are. They're good people. And they were going to help us get that boat, that automobile off of that ferry. And they did. And we got it down under, got it off of the ferry and onto the bank while the water was up over the seats of the car. And naturally, the car wouldn't run. But anyway, they fastened a rope to the tail end of the wagon. And with the mules, they pulled us down through the bottom land with this car, until we got up there to Roma. And that's where we met old Captain DeVertz. When we got to Roma, we went up there and advised him of our experience over across the river. He made us comfortable for that day. We left the next day and went reported back. Now that's one of the most thrilling things I've ever been in my life. When it come to a gunfight, I never did get much of a thrill out of it. I didn't. All I had wanted to do was just get another shot in, but make everyone count when I had any gunfights.
Could you, Mr. Peavy, could you tell us or list some of the wild tales maybe told to you by captured bootleggers, the kind of stories that they would come up with after you caught them?
Yes, they would try to convince us that it was somebody else responsible for what they had done, and that if we'd let them go, it would be a blessing to them, and that they didn't mean to violate the law, but they did it anyway. And they were as much excited as anything. I'll tell you a story about that. On one occasion, there was an old. Some of the work that we did. There was a bootlegger coming into this country all the time by the name of Bert Stoner, and he was a gangster from up in the upstate somewhere up around Oklahoma City or Fort Worth up there, and he was continually making trips into the valley and hauling out alcohol and liquor, and every officer in this valley was trying to catch him. And seemed like that nobody had any luck. So I told the fellows that I was working with, I said, I'm going to catch that fellow. I think I can. I said, I think I can get the information on him. So I went to the, they said, well, if you can, that's fine. So I went to the river one night, about 9 o'clock, and I got a hold of a boy down there by the name of Carmelo Ochoa that I knew very well. Now, this place where he lived was at Ocoyawa, southwest of Mission. And I told him, I said, I want you to go across the river and see a certain man over there and tell him I want to talk with him. Now, this certain man, I had caught him with liquor before, and I knew he was a bootlegger, and he knew that I knew he was a bootlegger. And you tell him I'd like to talk with him at the intake pipes at the Pinitas pump between 12 and 1 o'clock tonight. And I said, now I'll give you $5 to go over there and see him. You cross the river. They had their little skiffs all along the river then, you know. Some pictures of it in my book. And I said, now you bring me back word whether if you'll meet me there. So he went across, and after about an hour and a half, 2 hours, he came back. And he said, yeah, he'll meet you there tonight at 1 o'clock. But he said he wants you to be alone. I said, I will be alone. So at 1 o'clock, I drove up the military road, parked my car in the brush, and I walked down to the river and to the intake pipes at the pump. You know those irrigation pumping plants had large pipes. They took the water out of the river for irrigating, fill these canals with water for irrigation purposes. And so after a while, I heard him putting his skiff into the river, and he came over. And I said, the fog was just, it was like a fog hanging over the water. It looked like about 4 feet from the water. In fact, pretty soon I saw him coming up. And he said, is that you, Peavy? And I said, yes. He said, are you alone? I said, yes, I'm alone. So he came out. Well, you don't, under those circumstances, you never pop the question to him right quick. You just wait a little while. So I rolled a cigarette. I was smoking Bull Durham's tobacco, and I handed him the sack, and he rolled a cigarette. And I asked him the things and what the news was and what was going on. And after a while, I said to him, I said, Alberto, I want to catch Bert Stoner. And I said, I have reason to believe that you can help me catch him. He said, no. Did anybody tell you I could help him, help you? I said, no. I said, something inside of me told me that. And I said, I had the feeling that you can, if you will. And I'd like to catch that fellow, because I said, he's a rough character, and I want to get a hold of him. And he says, well, I said, would you sell him out? And he thought just a minute. He said, well, yes, I'll sell him out. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do, Alberto. I'll give you, if I catch him, I'll give you $20. And if I don't catch him, I won't catch him, I won't pay you anything. How's that? Is that a deal? Oh, yes. He said, that's all right. He said, if you'll do what I tell you to do, you'll catch him. You're bound to catch him. He says, you go back to your house. He said, I know where you live. And I was living in Mission then. And he came to my house one night, about 2 weeks later, and he said, Bert Stoner and two gangsters are here from up in Oklahoma City. And he said, they're going to take out 500 gallons of alcohol tomorrow night. And he says, they're going to cross it at down at Oak of the Owl. And I said, have you talked to, do you know for certain that they're here for that purpose? Yes, he said, I just left their room. They're in the Mission Hotel in room number 6. And he said, I just left their room. And he said, those fellows, he said, the three of them, he said, one, it take two, three of you to make one of them. He said, they're big men. And he said, they're mean-looking fellows, too. And he said, I saw two 45 automatic pistols on the mantelpiece in that room when I was there. And I said, who's going to cross the booze over? He said, I am. I said, well, he said, I said, how are they going to haul it out of here? Up there. He said, we're going to haul it in a truck. And he says, Stoner's riding in a Lincoln automobile. And he says, would you like to see the truck they're going to haul it out in? I said, yes, I sure would. He said, well, I'll take you and show you the truck. It's right here back of the Farmer's Gin Mission. So we went out, got my car, and drove over to the Farmer's Gin, and there, sure enough, there was a truck there. It was the right new Chevrolet truck with a black cab on it and the blue body. And he says, they'll go in between 1 and 2 o'clock tomorrow night, and they'll pick up that load on the river. And he says, if you follow that road. So I looked in the truck, and I saw some baled hay in there. And I said, what's the idea of carrying that hay in there? Well, he says, after the truck is loaded, they put this baled hay on top of it, and it, you fellas think it's a load of hay going down the road and you don't pay attention to it. But he says the booze will be underneath the hay. So he says, don't come near the river because you'll catch me. He says, you catch them on that road as they come out of the Ochoa pasture. And he says, you can't. But he says, you better take somebody else with you. He says, you need 2 or 3 more men with you. I said, that's all right. I'll take care of that part of it. I said, if I get to look at them, I said, they won't hurt me. So I got a hold of 2 of the other officers. After he left, I went and told these other 2 officers, Merle Vinson and Lee Terrell, who were working with me. And I told them what information I had. And I said, now, if you don't feel like going, I said, I'm afraid we'll have trouble with them because they're all armed. And I says, we may have a gunfight down there. And I said, if you don't feel like going, I'll get somebody else. Oh, hell no, we're going with you. If you go, we go. So we went down there and left a car about 1/2 mile from the river, walked in there on this road. I laid down on the ground right by the trail that went down to the river. And about 1 o'clock, sure enough, here come that truck, and they're without any lights on, down this trail. And it was the cab, and it was the truck that I had seen back of the gym, see? And I could hear them putting the cases into the truck. So I heard them start the motor up. And I told Terrell and Vincent, I said, you go around the curve, right up there. And I said, I'm going to catch them right here on this, right here. And I said, if they gun me down or they run me down at the truck, I said, don't let them get out of here alive. I said, you open up on them with that machine gun and just cut them down. So directly here come the truck, and I stepped out, take the truck, throw it a big flashlight in my hand, those 5 cells, you know, they're powerful. And there were the 3 men, just like I thought they were going to be, you know. They were those 3 storming those other 2 gangsters. And I thought, well, there they are. And I, just as soon as they stopped, I was right at the side door, you know. And these 2, the man that was driving the truck, his name, Tomas Sainz, he threw his hands up. And the other fellow's name was Eliseo Garcia. He was on my side, and he threw his hands up. They both knew me. But this other fellow sitting in the middle of the car, he went for his gun. He had a gun on. The other 2 didn't have any. And when he did, I cut down. Shot his own. Well, it was an unfortunate thing, but it would have been either he or I, because he was ready and I was too, but I was faster than he was. And that was the difference. And I made the apprehension. Anyway, on another occasion, there was an old Jew that came down to this country, and he was a peddler going around in an old Model T Ford. This is another case. Now I'm going to finish that other one first. Hold on. All right. I went before the grand jury and was exonerated from any. I was considered self-defense. And so I was attending a short time later. 2 weeks or so, I was attending the 93rd District Court here in Edinburgh, and as a witness in a murder case where a Mexican from the Mexican side had killed a Mexican boy with a shotgun, and I had caught him. Buck Copeland and I caught him, and we were both witnesses in the case, and I was a witness before the petty jury in this court. Well, when the trial came up, and Jim Bates, who was now our senator from here, was a district attorney, and so Bill Schaefer, the city marshal of Mission, he knew where I was, and he came to me at Edinburgh, and he had a Mexican boy with him. And he said, Johnny, he says, Bert Stoner's here, and he's just offered this boy $500 to kill you. So I talked to the Mexican, and I saw that he was sincere. He meant he was telling the truth. So I went. I made up my mind what I was going to do. I went and told Bill, Jim Bates. I said, I want off about an hour. If you can spare me from this case, just that moment, and I'll be back. I've got unfinished business I want to tend to. So I went over to. He let me off, and I went. I took Bill with me, and I said, Bill, I want you to go with me now. I said, I want to see if Bert Stoner's got the guts he thinks he has. I said, I'm going to give him a chance to pull his gun, and I'm going to kill him. And he says, well, he said, all right, you say so. I said, that's what I'm going to do. So the Mexican that brought the information, and Bill Schaefer and myself, we three went to Mission. And I went into the Mission Hotel where this boy said he was. It was in the same hotel where they had been when they hauled the booze out. And I asked the clerk there, I said, is Bert Stoner registered here? He said, well, there's a fella here, they call him Stoney, up in room 6. He said, he's been here before, many times. He said, they call him Stoney. I said, well, if I said, is he up there in the room now? And he says, clerk says, no, he just left. Well, from that day on, I was very careful about where I was staying and where, when I went into if I entered a restaurant or any place at all, a public place, I always stayed myself with near the wall. I never walked out with my back to the people that were in there. I was protecting myself against some unknown person that might have tried to assassinate me. I knew that if I was looking, he wouldn't do it, because I was faster. There wasn't nobody could beat me to the draw. And so I was called up to San Antonio on another case to the headquarters of the Immigration Service. And on my way back that night, I stopped at Alice to get a cup of coffee. And I picked up, there was a newspaper on the counter there with a big headline, Bert Stoner, notorious gangster, Oklahoma City, gunned down by another gangster. And that took the heat off of me. I felt pretty good about that. On another occasion, when we were scouting on the river, I was working with a fellow by the name of Lee Terrell, and the sheriff had phoned me, Sheriff Hidalgo County had phoned me and told me that while we were working along the river, in the event we found a car anywhere along there, and he gave us the number plates of the car, he says, we have reason to believe this fellow has been done away with, this fellow by the name of Redmond, Lou Redmond. He was a Jew peddler, going around the country selling dry goods to these little Mexican towns, you know, and Mexican. You see, they didn't have stores then like they do now everywhere. And he was selling calico and stuff, that material for making clothing. And these Mexicans were buying it, and he would extend credit to them. And then every month he would go and make the rounds. And he had a fellow with him that he always used by the name of Silver. And this fellow Silver lived at Peñitas, and he used to get this fellow every time he came down here. He'd always get him to chauffeur him around because he didn't know the roads, you know, how to go to these different ranches. But this fellow, this Mexican fellow by the name of Silver, did. And he would buy his dry goods from old Sam Greenfield at Mission, who was a had a store there, a wholesale store of such things as buttons and material to make clothing. And he'd peddle it around the country, and he always got this fellow Silver to drive him. So, but he disappeared, car and all. and his family from Fort Worth, or I believe, no, they were from Lubbock, Texas. They phoned the sheriff and told him that he had disappeared, that he hadn't come home. He was supposed to have been at home. Well, he didn't. They didn't know what became of him. So the sheriff phoned me and told me and gave me the numbers of the car and the description of the man and all that. And a fellow by the name of Lee Terrell and I, one of the officers, were scouting in the vicinity of Pinitas. And we found the river. The river had been up, but when we came along there, it had fallen down. And there was an automobile down in the river. And the water had gone down far enough to where we could read this license plate numbers. So I went right back to the pumping station to call up Bob Daniels, the sheriff, and told him. I said, we found that car. If you send some of the officers over here, we pull that out of the river and see what's happened. So he sent George Danette. He was a part Mexican, but he was a deputy sheriff and a good one. And so he came over, and we took him over there to where the car was. And so then we got a wrecker and pulled it up out of the river. And there was a lot of barbed wire twisted around the steering post of the car, this old Model T Ford. And it had been stripped, even taken the spark plugs out. They'd taken the tires off. Everything was gone off the car that could be sold in Mexico. And while we were working on that, Dr. Bennett, there in Mission, the doctor there, called up the sheriff, and he says, I've just dressed a Mexican for a gunshot wound in the shoulder. And he said he shot himself. He was hunting, and he shot himself accidentally. And he said, I don't believe son of a bitch telling the truth. I think he's a liar. He said, I think somebody shot that Mexican. So Bob Daniels called George, and George and I went over there to find this Mexican. We found him. We talked with him. And he gave us a lot of lines about how he shot himself and all that. George got tired of hearing that after a while, and he gave him a kick in the butt and loosened up his tongue a little bit and told him, go ahead and tell us the truth. Now he told us all the lies he knew, now tell us the truth. And he admitted that he was the silver that was driving the car for this redman. So George kept working on him. George was an expert on questioning, cross-examining a Mexican outlaw like that. And he kept the pressure on him, and he finally told him, he said, well, he says, my two cousins and I made up a scheme to rob this man, he said. And he said, they knew that I knew where he'd be all the time. He said, they suggested that when they come up the military road, that they'd step out and make a fake stick up. And so they did. And he says, they searched me first, then took what money I had, and then they turned around to search the Jew, and when they did, he broke and run, and they shot at him, and shot him through the neck, and the same bullet that hit this man hit me in the shoulder. All right, we had a case there. Now we asked him, what's that barbed wire doing wrapped around that steering wheel? He said, well, you see, after we killed him, and they took him, we didn't know what to do with him. So we decided to take the car down to the river and take all the dry goods out of it and take it across the river. And then he said, we got $400 off of him. And but what would we do with him? He was a dead man, and how could we get rid of him? So we decided to put him in the car and tie him in there with barbed wire, with fence wire, and then push the car off into the river. And he said the river was high, and it covered the car all up. And he said, well, everything is all right. But he said a few days later, the river went down, And he said, there it was, a man tied in the car, and everybody could see it. Of course, not very many people go in there along the river, you know, but whoever would see a man tied. And he said, we decided the best thing to do with him is take him out of the car and take him across the river and bury him in the sandbar over there on the other side. We got the whole confession out of him. Well, we caught the other two. And well, we went to trial on the case. And the only reason that we couldn't get a conviction, we got him 40 years in jail. And the only what we were after was the death penalty for murder and robbery. But the only reason that we couldn't put that to him was because that we couldn't produce the body. Under the law, you had to produce the body. But we couldn't get it because we buried him on the other side. But anyway, the court gave him 40 years in the penitentiary. And the last I heard, they were still there. Those are the things that...
could you mention some of the more famous names or some of the bandits that you personally have started out with? And...
Well, I didn't start out with them. I started out after them.
Started out after?
Yes. Well, they had various ones. They had, when I was with the horseback unit, working up on in Jim Hogg County and all the way back to the river, we were scouting with the rangers in there, and that's why we had more of our. They were smugglers, and they were carrying booze from the Rio Grande River up as far as the Tex-Mex Railroad, which comes through Alice and San Diego, and up in Duval County, which a notorious county of Texas for outlawness. That's where the transfer of this booze was made to cars, because this country here was being patrolled by so many officers on these highways that these big loads couldn't get through, would be caught if they were brought through on the car, by car, you see. But they were horsebacking it. Pack trains, 25 or 30 horses packed with this booze. Sometimes there'd be 2,000-3,000 bottles of booze that were tequila that was being smuggled up there. And we were working in that area up there apprehending those people. And they were armed just like we were. Every time we intercepted any of them, we had a gunfight with them. And we had a lot of excitement there. They, on one occasion, I was scouting with a fellow by the name of Roy Harold. Now, Roy was an 8th breed Cherokee Indian, and he used to work for the King Ranch before he became a lawman down here. And he and I were put together by our superiors to work in that country up there. And on one occasion, we found some a trail where these smugglers had gone through. So we followed this trail by the footprints, you know. And we went over a gravel hill, and there was we found a Mexican over there that had a herd of goats. And he was deaf and dumb. He couldn't talk, and he was deaf too. But Roy was able to talk to him. Roy was a regular monkey. If he'd have had any chance at all, he would have made a wonderful performer in these TV pictures and Western pictures. He could rope and ride anything that had hair on it. I don't care where it was. Four-legged horse didn't mean a thing to him. He was as wild as he could be. Anyway, Roy threw his hands. He could speak Spanish better than he could English. And he threw the hand sign and language, he convinced this dummy that we wanted to know where these men were that were put these tracks here. And he said, pointed down down through a valley there. You see, that's gravel hill country up there. And that they'd gone down there. So we went over there and we found their pack horses. They had unpacked them and hidden the booze. So we tried to find the men, but They saw us coming and they got away on foot. So we repacked the animals, and about that time a norther blew up in the north, and boy, it started blowing and raining like the devil, you know. And so we started toward Benavides, that's in Duval County, and we hadn't gone very far before we came to a low place in the road, and there was a Model T car sitting there in the mud hole there, and the rain was just coming down in sheets. And naturally, we went up to see what the trouble was, and they were stuck. So I got down and I pulled back. They had side curtains. There's old time cars, you know, they had curtains on the side, no glass. And I pulled the back curtain back, and there's old Dr. Strickland from Alice was sitting in there. And he said, "My God, am I glad to see you." He said, "I've been out here helping an old Mexican woman give birth to a child," and he says, "I got caught in this storm," and he says, "I'm tired and hungry," and he said, "Do you all have any tequila?" I said, "Yeah, I've got 300 bottles." "Oh," he says, "bring me one." So I went back to one of the pack animals and got a bottle of tequila and handed it to him. And he said, "Here, you boys, get in here out of the rain a little while." And so we uncorked this bottle of tequila, and he took a snort of it, and he said, "Now listen, you all have a shot of this." He said, "You know what the good book says, is it, muzzle not the ox that trudges out the corn." And so we did, and it helped both of us, helped him. And so finally we decided we better be moving, so we fastened our lariats to the front end of the car, you know, and from the horn of the saddle, we pulled him out of the mud hole and got him started. So we went on into Benavides. He was ahead of us, of course. He got along fine the rest of the way home because he's on a hard road. And we followed on into Benavides. So it was about, I guess, about 1 o'clock. Got to Benavides, and old Camilo Ramirez was a constable over there in Benavides at that time, and we called him, and he came out, helped us unpack the horses and take care of them, and then went in the house, and his wife had taken, he didn't have any children, just he and his wife, and his wife had put clean sheets on the bed, and she had made a pallet on the floor, and they insisted that Roy and I get in their bed and sleep the rest of the night. We had a hair all over our faces. We were really a rough looking gang, and he and his wife slept on this pallet on the floor in the same room. Well, we had taken our 300 bottles of tequila we had put in his kitchen. And so we woke up about 11 o'clock the next morning, and she had a pot of hot coffee all ready for us. And when we went to load up our pack horses again and go on into Alice with it, but there was 80 bottles of that booze gone. And so we asked him, "What became of the other?" He said, "Well, Lee Peters came in here this morning and he stole 80 bottles." Lee Peters was a ranchman up there. And you know, there are no people on earth like these ranch people. They have time to laugh and talk and tell stories, and they're different from this old life that you live in town. It's dog eat dog and grind every day the same old thing. And there's no change, it's always the same. You do today what you did yesterday and the day before. And really, the life that I lived in those days was something worthwhile, and it, to me, it was something wonderful, because we had a lot of excitement. And now, on another occasion, when I was a scout there, I'd been detailed to, we had the Mexican outlaws had killed a man by the name of Longoria, who was one of our scouts down here at Santa Maria. That's Santa Maria's little town on the Mexican, right down around on the river, on the military road, below Mercedes. And so the colonel told me, he said, "I think we better retaliate." He says, "I think we better do something about that." He says, he said, "We can't do much." He said, "Wilson's ordered us not to fire a shot that hit the Mexican side of the river because," he said, "it might bring on an international situation." Well, they didn't have any organized government over there, so it was a silly order because they had nobody over there to contest it, you see, or to make a complaint of it, because they had no head of their government. If he'd have thought twice, he wouldn't have ordered such an order. And this colonel told me, he said, "We can't do it because we have that executive order." But he said, "You can." So we decided to go after him. So I made a bait with a fellow by the name of Tom January, who was one of our men, and he was a half Indian, and a fellow by the name of Earl West, who was scouts. So I made a date with him to meet me south of Santa Maria. And we'd lay for those fellows, do work them over a little bit. And I left Fort Brown just there silent and reveille in the morning. The soldiers were getting up. And by that evening, I was up the San Benito pump, and I spent the night there. And the next morning, I started on off the river to meet them at Santa Maria. And I was riding with my reins in my hand and my Winchester across my arm. I never carried it down in the scabbard because I wanted it where I could use it quick. And I had the hand on the horn of my saddle like that. And there was, they ambushed me on the Mexican side. You see, there was a trail cut right along the bank of the river where the soldiers used to ride. And they shot at me from the Mexican side. Well, I couldn't see them, because they were in the brush, and that bullet just caught me right across the back of the hand. And I knew I was in ambush, but, and your subconscious mind, you don't stop and say, what shall I do? You do it. You do it automatically. It's your subconscious mind goes ahead and tells you what to do. I fell from my horse to convey to them that I had been killed. And I laid right flat on the ground. My horse went to munching grass around there. And after a while, he threw up his head, he cocked up his ears and went across the river, and I was watching him. And they were coming out of the brush on the Mexican side, about eight of them. And they had these big Mexican hats on. And they were coming by. What they were going to do, come over and get my saddle and gun and horse, you see. And, well, they came out of the brush, yeah. And two of them did, Bolden and the rest of them. They walked out on the sandbar, you know, and they were ready to go to wading across. The river was only about knee-deep water. And when they got back away from that brush, be each one of them had a Winchester in his hand. And I was laying prone on the bank, and I plugged one of them right through his, where his belt buckle fastened. And the other one reeled to run. I caught him where his hind legs fastened to his tailbone and let him have it. And I got two of them right there. And I said, the rest of them naturally disappeared. I crawled back away from the river then. I whistled to my horse. He came. We had him trained to come to us when we whistled to him. He came to me, and I got up on him. Went over to the army camp, got my hand dressed, and we, to a certain extent, we felt like we'd retaliated for what had happened a few days before when they killed a scout.
Mr. Peavy, could you tell us a little about the problems that you had with prostitution along the border?
Yes, we've had, on one occasion, I was working with a fellow by the name of Stanley Morton, and old Stanley was he was about 6.5 feet high, and he was born and raised in Kentucky, and he was a wild actor. I said, he and I were scouting down on the road south of Hidalgo one night about midnight, and we found where a car had turned into a lane, found the tracks in the mud where it had turned into the lane and gone to the river. And we knew that the car was still in there because of the tracks. We knew what we were doing. And we decided to wait and see who was going to come out of that lane. So we waited there about 3/4 of an hour, and directly here a Ford car came up there, and they pulled up to the gate, and Stanley stood behind the post and the gate post, and well, this fella shoved his arm through the gate to unlatch the gate so they could bring the car out. Why, Stanley grabbed him by the arm, and he was a powerful man, and he pulled him right up and slugged him right up into the gate. And this fellow just jumping like a wild Indian trying to get loose, and old Sanders holding him right there, pinned against the gate, and with his arm. And he was giving him a twist there, and this fellow was trying to get away from him. And I had already gone inside the fence, and I stepped up to the car. Stanley had him under control, and I stepped up to the car to see what was in the car, and there's a Mexican taxi driver and 6 Mexican girls about 15 years old in the back of the car. So I immediately took this driver off to one side and questioned him, and old Stanley still had this fella pinned up against on the gate by the arm. And he told me, he said he's a Greek, and he says he persuaded some of these Mexican girls, Marinosa, to go with him to Erie, Pennsylvania, and that they'd make lots of money in his whorehouse up there. That he'd run a big house there, and he wanted to get some young Mexican girls up there and make lots of money for everybody. So by that time, old Stanley had released this fella and got him around, and then he was a Greek. And he had on a silk shirt, and he had a $50 bill in his pocket so that you could see the money sticking up in his coat shirt pocket. And he got started to tell us what a bad guy he was up at Erie, Pennsylvania. He said when the policeman up there saw him coming down the street, they'd run and hide in the alleys. He said they're afraid of him because he's a bad, bad fella. And Stanley hauled off and hit him with the butt of his rifle and knocked him cold. He says, "You ain't in Erie, Pennsylvania now." He says, "You son of a bitch." He says, "You're down in Texas." He says, "Nobody runs away from anybody down here." But he says, "I'm gonna teach you a lesson." He just worked him over real good. So the county had moved it from Hidalgo over to Edinburgh. That the headquarters, you see, the county seat, used to be at Hidalgo, and the old courthouse and the old jail was still there, and they had moved and built a new courthouse at what is now Edinburgh, over there. And they had given us permission to use the old jail to put these people our prisoners, to lock them up, because we were living at Hidalgo. And so this Greek, he'd been talking out of the side of his mouth too much for old Stanley, and decided we'd teach him a lesson or two. At that time, the old courthouse had an iron fence around it, and we took him out there. He wanted to go in the cell with these girls. We told him, "No, we're going to lock the girls up. We're going to lock you up outside." So we put the leg irons on him. They're just like big handcuffs, you know. And we leg ironed him to that iron fence and left him there all night. And believe me, that Greek was soft where he's hard. The next morning he was really a gentleman. And we never mistreated anybody, but when they got out of line, we had ways of handling them that justified the occasion.
Mr. Peavy, Could you describe the notorious town of San Diego around 1915-1920s?
Well, it was a full-fledged lawless place. They called it the Wild State of Duval. And the people that were living there, Parr was the Parr family, were the kingpins of the whole thing. It was a place where prostitution, gambling, horse racing, chicken fighting, anything that was lawless was going on. And that's where the bootleggers from the north would meet the bootleggers from the south, from Mexico. That was when the 18th Amendment to the Constitution was in effect. It was repealed, you know, in 1930 by Roosevelt. And that's where they had just about as lawless a place as you could imagine. And I was at Alice, right town below there. But we knew that's why they had us stationed there, because these horsebackers were bringing booze in there, into these big pastures. You never knew where the pasture was or what part they were going to be in. But we'd always trail them by the footprints of their horses, you know. That train wreck I mentioned in there is an interesting story. I was my brother and I and two other fellows were the first people there to that train that night. And I tell that story in there about how I found Judge Kleiber and Maurice Edelstein, the fellow that established these Edelstein stores in the valley. They were on that train. They were under the between the seats when I went in the car. You see, the sheriff, the sheriff, the train was due to get to arrive in Brownsville at 10:10 every night, the Houston train. And when it didn't arrive, he become alarmed because of the outlaw that were coming out of Mexico where you could expect almost anything. And so he tried to phone San Benito to see if the train had passed there. And he couldn't get out. Apparently the wires had been cut. And he called me. I was deputy sheriff then. And he called me and told me to arouse several of the other deputies and be ready, because he said, I don't know what's going to happen, what's happened, but he said, I know that something's wrong and I may need you all. And about an hour he phoned back to me and he said, I just talked to the porters who was on that train. He said, the train has been wrecked and set on fire on the Tandy, out near the Tandy switch. And he said, you boys get out there as fast as you can. Take your flashlights, plenty of ammunition, and be careful what you do. Well, we just jumped in the car and went right out there. But the porter had jumped off of the train when it hit the ditch. And he hit the ground a-running, this nigger porter. And he got the telephone, called the sheriff, you see, and then the sheriff called me. Well, we went right out there. We could see the fire. What we thought was the train burning as he had described it. but when we got up there, it was the trestle bridge over the lake, over the Resaca. See, those Resaca beds are old river beds, hundred years ago. And this railroad trestle went across this Resaca. And it was burning, and we could see the train across there. So we went over there, and when I walked in the coach, the passenger coach, they were running the mixed train, passenger and freight train cars. And when I walked into the passenger car, I could see down through the aisle, three men lying dead there on the floor, what I thought was dead. One of them wasn't. And I noticed a pair of feet sticking out underneath the seat. There was old man Maurice Edelstein and Judge Kleiber, district attorney from Brownsville at that time. And I looked at those two of those men dead, but another one was shot in the face, but he wasn't dead. And so I convinced Edelstein and Clive that there were no bandits. Bandits had long were gone, and that they could come out from under that seat. So they did. They were just covered with blood, but it wasn't their blood. It was from these two men that had been shot in the aisle. And they told me that Harry Wallace and Dr. McCain were in the men's toilet. They'd run in there and shut the door, locked it. And when I got up the door, there was bullet holes all through the door. They just actually shot through the door. And we convinced them that there were no more bandits, so they opened the door and we got them out. But Dr. McCain died a few minutes after we got him out of the cabin.
Mr. Pavey, where did you learn to shoot, fire your weapon at a very young age?
Where did I learn to shoot?
Yes, sir.
My father-in-law, when I first started in that line of work as a law enforcement officer, he told me, he said, I've been an officer all my life in this frontier country. And he said, I wouldn't be alive if I hadn't been quick on the draw. And so he taught me how to draw a gun from the holster and shoot from the hip. And I said, he used to always say, use your gun if you're at close range, but if you're not close, use your Winchester. And he says, the way to learn shooting, he said, it's just like pointing your finger. He said, if you want to see, there's the doorknob right there. He said, if you could look down your finger, you're right, you're pointing at it. That's the doorknob. It becomes second nature with a man if he practices it. It's just like any other work that a man might do. You take a man that's a prize fighter. He learns how to use his fist to the best advantage. But a man that's carrying a gun, he learns how to use that gun to the best of his efficiency. And his practice is what takes it. And if you stand in front of a mirror and start and watch your hand and continuously every day do a little of it, cranking it from the holster, cocking it as you bring it out and pull the trigger, that you get to where that it's just second nature with you. And he says, if your eyes are quick and you've got good judgment, he says, you'll be all right. But he says, if you don't practice it for self-defense, he says, it's a dangerous line of work to get into. I want to tell you a little story of how things happened. I was, when I was on patrol duty on one occasion, I was working with another officer that had recently been transferred from Florida to Texas. And we were scouting on Highway 107 north of Mission. And we passed about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we passed a truckload of cotton. And I spoke to this fellow, his name was Harrison. And I said, Harrison, there goes a load of stolen cotton. And he said, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. He said, the idea, how can you tell it's stolen cotton? I said, well, there's a difference, of course. I said, you boys know all about picking oranges and grapefruit and bananas and that stuff, but we boys down here are cotton picking people. And I said, there's a difference. And he said, oh, he said, that's ridiculous. I said, all right, let's catch those fellows and find out. So I was driving the car, and I turned the car around, and we took in after them, and overtook them and stopped them. And I took the driver of the truck, and I told him, I said, you watch these two fellows here, and make them sit right there in the truck and stay there while I get the information from this one. So I took him off to one side. And he was terribly nervous. He didn't know what I was going to beat him up or something. I told him, no, I said, I'm not going to hurt you. I said, I just want to talk to you. I said, here, roll your cigarette. And I handed him a Bull Durham sack. And then he rolled a cigarette, and I did. I said, who y'all working for? And he told me who this working for. Out at all. I said, what, all of you? All three of you? Yes. Your families live on the farm there on the ranch where you're working? Yes. I said, did you steal the cotton from those people? He said, I didn't have nothing to do with that cotton, stealing that cotton. He says, I own the truck. And he said, I'm just hauling it for these two fellas. I said, then they stole it, huh? He says, I don't know whether they stole it or not. He says, I'm just hauling it for them. So I took him over and I handcuffed him to a mesquite tree where he couldn't leave. And I called one of the others out there and I said, this fella here told me he didn't have anything to do with stealing that cotton. He says that he owns the truck and he's hauling it for you all. And you all was the ones that stole it. And he told me what he's going to do with it. And because I said the cotton gins have been closed for a month and he couldn't gin it. And I said he was going to take it down South Mission. He said, did he tell you all that? I said, he sure did. Well, he says, he's a liar. He helped us steal it. And said, well, now, I said, how did you steal it? He said, well, when we're picking the cotton, we're going down the road toward the brush. And he said, we empty that sack in the brush. Then we come back on the next row and we'd weigh that into the wagon and get paid for picking. Then at night, we'd go down there and take it from there and take it over to Manuel's house until we get a bale. And then he said we'd take it down to South Mission and sell it to Juan Martinez, and he holds it till next year when the gins open up again. So I said, all right, fine. So we took them and went on in town with them, and I put them at that time. Mission had a jail underneath the city hall. It's right where the bank is now up there. And I locked them up in the cells down there. I called these people up and told them, I said, I've got one of your three men in here. And I said, I got them locked up. They said, they stole a couple of bales of cotton from you. And I said, I caught them with this one. And I said, this fellow's out. And I don't want to mention the name, but confidentially, they're very influential people here. And I said, there's no mistake. I said, they've stolen the cotton from you. And he says, well, I don't know why they'd steal anything from us. We try to help them every time they have trouble or anything. He said, I'll be right in there. So he and his brother came in. I made him stand back of the door. Now I said, you just listen to the answers I get from the questions I ask. And I went to the cell and asked them, and they just tore it out and told me all about it. You know, how they stole the cotton, they're picking it down this way, and they put that in the brush. And then this up here, they'd weigh it back in the wagon. But I had to prove it to this fellow working for me, really, from Florida, because he hadn't had any idea. Now, a lot of my catches that I made were that way with me. I had a hunch. And I used to have awful good hunches. On one occasion, I was working on the river at a place they called Los Evans up here in Texas, up northwest of Mission. And in the middle of this, about midnight, and a boat came over, and a woman got out of a little skiff. A woman got out of the skiff, and the fellow running the skiff, these shot right back to the other side. So we caught the woman. I said, questioned her about her nationality, where she was born. She told me, she said, my mother lives in Los Evans. That's on this side of the river. And San Miguel is on the Mexican side, right across the river. And I said, so I questioned her, and I said, well, you're an American, U.S. citizen. You go ahead. We'll let you go. And she went about 20 feet, I guess, 30. She stopped and came back. She says, Would you like to catch Pancho Chinchilla? Now, Pancho Chinchilla was a nickname. His name was Pancho Garza. But a chinchilla is a roach, cockroach. And the Mexican gave him that nickname because he's so ornery. And she said, would you like to catch Pancho? I said, yeah, sure would. I said, I've been trying to catch him for 11 years. She said, well, if you do it, I tell you, you'll catch him. So she told me. All right. I said, wait, what do you turn him in for? He said, well, he was I was his woman. And he says, because I was great big and fat and old, he says, he fell in love with a young woman, and he says, he run me off. And he says, I was just coming back to my mama. And it was 7 months. Well, I did what she said, what she told us, and we went and laid for him, and we caught Pancho. Pack horses, you know, loaded up. Now, his real name was Pancho Garza, but the Mexicans gave him around here that knew him gave him that nickname, and he was a professional bootlegger. That's all he did, and he was a very clever one. I know of several times that they nearly caught him. Some of the officers nearly caught him, but he always managed to either get away or evade the apprehension, being apprehended by the officer. And on one occasion, he was a sort of a peculiar person. He told me, after we apprehended him, this time with these pack horses, where the woman had turned him in, and we had him in custody, and he told me on one occasion that he was carrying a whole wagon load with a pair of mules from Garciaville to Heavenville up on through the wagon road. And he said he had a hunch that he told me that he lived on hunches, that was the way he was able to evade apprehension. He had a hunch. And he said, on this special occasion, he was tearing this load, a wagon, an old wagon, a pair of mules, and a load of booze. And he was on his way to Heavenville with it. And he's had a hunch that the officer's waiting for him at a gate. So he parked his wagon, and he went afoot out through the brush, and said when he got up to this gate, he said, there were the officers there. He says, you see, I didn't know they were there, but he says, something told me it was there was up there. And he says, I just turned around with the wagon, went around on another road, and went on all the way up to San Diego and sold my booze. It was real life those days.
Is he still living today?
Yes.
Did you tell us where he is?
Well, he's supposed to be living at Rachel up there, this side of Falturas, working for somebody on the ranch, but I don't know what ranch it is. But everybody in the country knew Chinchillo. That is his record, his name. It was a nickname, of course. He was a pretty clever fellow. But I don't think he's bootlegging any. Well, of course, they repealed the 18th Amendment, you know, and then they opened up saloons. There was no more reason to be bootlegging. Gunrunners, too. I've caught a lot of that, you know. You see, on one occasion, I tell that story in my book about that Captain Reed, the life at the Coast Guard station at Port Isabel. He reported to the district commander about seeing a shrimp boat under suspicious circumstances, and he reported, and we went and investigated, and we found it wrecked down there at the mouth of the river. And it was several cases of Savage and Winchester rifles on board there. And we went down there with a pair of mules and a buckboard from the army to this place and got these. I had several guns out of it, and we threw the rest of them in the river down there. But they were hit. This shrimp boat had been wrecked by a storm. You see, years ago, these storms were never announced. And they'd have a tropical storm hit this country where nobody knew it until the shingles began to fly off the house. Then you knew there was a storm blowing. And there was no means of conveying that information to the people. And they just took it as a matter of course, you know, and expect such things. It was.
Were the wetbacks during this time, during the early period, 1920s, were they just taken back over to Mexico and released like they are now?
Mm-hmm. Deported.
Deported, same yes. Procedure taking place today.
Apprehended and deported, yes. And we used to deport a bunch of them, and the next day they'd all be back over. It was just the biggest piece of monkey business that ever was with the enforcement of immigration laws, and still is. And these boys that they have in the Border Patrol now, they've been to school and they've taught them how to do things. But these old boys that were in my time, they didn't know what a schoolhouse was, and we made better apprehensions than they do. We used to get the culprit that smuggled them over too. And there's no penalty attached to it, you see. Now, there were cases where I used to have a sympathy for them. I mentioned that in my book. On one occasion, I was scouting on the river, and I met a man and a bunch of children. There were two men and a bunch of children coming, and the children were all crying. So, naturally, I had to interview them, and I asked them regularly. Questions that we customarily asked about where they were coming from and where they were going. So, and they were wet, pure D wet bags. And I asked him, I said, why are the children crying? And he said, well, he said, the boatman wouldn't cross us over because we didn't have any money to pay for putting us across the river. And he said, we decided to cross it, wade across. And he says, my wife, the mother of these children, stepped in a hole and fell and drowned. And he said, that's what the children are crying about. And I always had a sympathy for them. I have a sympathy for anyone at all for violation of the law. If they act decent about it, I feel sorry for them. That's the way I've always been. I've had a feeling like that maybe circumstances that we don't know anything about has brought this about and caused them to do these things. You get off a lot of patience, though, I'll tell you sometimes. Especially when they're breaking in houses for broad daylight, you know, and stealing like they do. I've never mistreated a prisoner. I can truthfully say that. I just always felt maybe that what brought this was circumstances in their lives that they weren't taught any different. It's sort of difficult for me to talk to this machine, and when I know it's being recorded, and if somehow or other I could tell a story if I'm looking into the faces of many people, such as a group, an audience that I was talking to, because I said I can relate to things that kind of bring laughter back to me and from them to me and to me to them. And it's been kind of difficult, but this book that I've written, Echoes from the Rio Grande, is a true story of some of my experiences in this frontier country. I can truthfully say there's not a falsehood in it. And I said, what I have written in that book, I have a document to prove every word that I say. I've been complimented highly by people that knew me in the olden days for the manner in which I've written this book. They say it isn't only that it's somewhat like a chain, links of a chain. One story interlocks with another. And I said I've had the most wonderful success with the book and have been complimented from people everywhere. And I have sold over 5,000 copies. I've made a profit on this book, and I'm proud to say of around $15,000. And I put that all, I didn't need the money, and I put it all out at 5% as fast as I got it. And I said, it's earning now, earning me money. I've got that put away. My books are for sale in all of the big bookstores of the country. I've sold them in St. Louis, in Minneapolis, sold some in Boston. In fact, I sent 7 copies to London, England. And what has always interested me with regard to that is that it would have cost me more to send that 7 books from here to New York than it did for me to send them to London, England. Now, I said I never could understand it, but I believe there's a treaty for the handling of such things between our two governments, the English government and ours. But it has always been a mystery to me. It costs more to send a book to London, to New York, than it does to send it to London, England.